From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The United States spends more than $300 billion each year to build up and build out its military. That's $300 billion down the drain, anti-war historian Howard Zinn says, for all the cash the U.S. pumps into training the most powerful and sophisticated military in the world. Howard Zinn says none of it is making the U.S. safe against terrorism. This hour, On Point, a historian, Howard Zinn, on America's new war. We begin with the guilty verdict in the Arthur Anderson trial. On Saturday, the 10th day of deliberations, jurors found the company guilty of obstruction of justice, the first felony conviction of a major U.S. accounting firm. I spoke today with the jury's foreman, Oscar Kreiner. I asked him how he felt about the verdict now that it's been delivered.
I am comfortable with it. I had a number of days to internalize it and to see how it fit into the instructions and the law as presented by the judge, and I'm fully aware of the act, so I think I'm comfortable with the decision.
You yourself, Mr. Kreiner, reportedly were on the fence for a long time in this Anderson trial and only late in the game became confident of a guilty vote. What made the difference for you?
Well, I saw a lot of difficulties in the case. Most of the people did not admit to destroying documents, having been issued orders to destroy documents to anyone. Most of it was trying to get their house in order and apply their document retention policy. It just turned out that document retention policy had some document destruction parts in it, but it also said that if you were in threatening litigation, you should not destroy anything. But, you know, given that kind of circumstantial piece there, I mean, people were saying they didn't take it too seriously. They did it. Mm-hmm. They didn't do it. So it wasn't really enforced, if you see.
You know, of course, Anderson employees have said all along and are still saying today that they've been unfairly targeted by the government here. Someone called it the murder of a great corporation. What would you say to Anderson employees who do not feel fairly treated?
They haven't read the law and understand the intricacies of the particular law that they were charged with. And they have to look at that carefully and see that the act that was performed really fit the law so tightly that there was nothing that could be done. And the other point about this is, if you look at the judge's instructions, you know, they didn't have to know that they were breaking the law. And so that also says that, you know, some people in Anderson were not being trained well enough, or maybe it's in the law schools, or maybe it's in the business schools, I don't know, but somebody didn't know they were breaking the law when they did that.
Was there evidence that, in fact, Anderson employees did know that they were breaking the law?
Yes. In the case of the corrupt persuader, oh, yes, she knew.
This was the Anderson attorney saying, take my name off the memo, please.
Yes. Okay. And also remove some language that might suggest that we have concluded the release is misleading. Mm-hmm. Well, they already knew that the release was misleading, and they already knew that they didn't agree with Enron, and they couldn't get Enron to behave, so Enron went on out and said that it was non-recurring, and they knew that was going to bring the SEC in. They should have stonewalled it and told the SEC we disavow Enron, but they didn't. They tried to hide the fact.
What do you think Enron's influence on Arthur Anderson was here? Arthur Anderson, for decades, was known as a bastion of integrity in the American world. What was Enron's influence?
That is so disappointing to me personally, you know, because I really had a problem with that. But it was clear that the relationship had moved from just the auditor to the auditor consultant, and then it got a little more close, and then it became so close that the engagement partner was not telling the whole truth to the rest of the partnership. Mm-hmm. And things like that kind of went on and on and on, and so it was clear that the company was too close.
Of course, even before the verdict came out, and certainly since it's come out, the consequences for Anderson are dire and may lead to the company's end or being broken up so much that it doesn't resemble the former company at all.
That's correct.
What do you feel about that consequence of this prosecution?
Well, you know, American business history is full of stories of companies that have made mistakes, and those mistakes have been devastating. It has to do, I think, a lot with the education of the people coming in and the training that they have. I think a lot of what Anderson did had to do with the fact that the people were not trained in the processes and in the quality of their work.
And specifically in issues of integrity?
Yes, issues of integrity, issues of completing the work papers, issues of making all the things come together so that when you finish an account, you've got a set of documents that are, you know, already fixed. You don't have to go back and tinker with them.
Put us in the midst of the jury. As you approached and finally came to your final decision on Saturday in the jurors' room, what was the mood there?
It was somber. It was somber all the way. This was a very serious jury, and people were quiet. We spent at least 2, maybe 3 days in just quiet reading and study. When we came to the conclusion, it wasn't a point of celebration, but a point of disappointment.
Was there a sense that you had done something historic?
Yes, but we didn't dwell on it. It was, you know, there, we've done it, so, okay, that's it.
Oscar Kreiner, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Oscar Kreiner was jury foreman in the Arthur Anderson trial. Mr. Kreiner is a computer science professor at Texas Southern University. He spoke with me from Houston. In his latest book, Terrorism and War, anti-war historian Howard Zinn calls for Americans to start a, quote, real revolution in our thinking about war and history and the world. Howard Zinn says if the United States wants to ever find real security, it must change its posture in the world. That means stop using military power to intervene in other countries' affairs and stop dominating other countries' economies. Uncaring American power and wealth, Zinn argues, have created a reservoir of potential terrorists around the world who have suffered at the hands of the United States and are ready to strike back. This hour, imagining a different response to terrorism, can the U.S. afford to back off from its global power projection? Could military action against terrorism actually put U.S. security at greater risk? Howard Zinn says there's no such thing as a just war, that war is inherently unjust. Do you agree? Did you lose your anti-war perspective on September 11th? Is it lost forever? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Howard Zinn, distinguished historian and professor emeritus at Boston University. He's a decorated World War II bombardier. Zinn was an active figure in the civil rights and anti-Vietnam War movements. He's author of several books, including the acclaimed A People's History of the United States. His latest book is Terrorism and War. Good evening and welcome, Howard Zinn.
Thank you.
And joining us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Mr. Zinn.
Hello, Jack Beatty. Are you there?
I'm here.
We'll have Jack
in
just
me?
A moment. Howard Zinn, you have written all your life from a perspective that is a bit outside the mainstream, from the perspective of someone who grew up in the slums of Brooklyn, as you described them, immigrant family, Jewish family, went to work in the shipyards early on and ended up volunteering for World War II, lost your taste for war, looking back on what went on in that war, and cannot muster, even today, taste for the war on terrorism, despite September 11th, despite the towers that fell just across the river from where you grew up. President Bush says that the country is fighting here for freedom and for democracy. Do you agree? And aren't those worthy things to fight for?
Well, are freedom and democracy worthy things to fight for? Oh, yes. It depends on what you mean by fight. There's certainly important things to struggle for and not to stop struggling for. But I don't believe that when you bomb a country like Afghanistan with a vague notion that you might be doing something against terrorism, that you might be rooting out terrorists, and in the process you end up killing a lot of innocent people, I don't believe you're advancing the cause of freedom and democracy at all. In fact, I think you're probably endangering freedom and democracy, because that freedom and democracy need to be respected in the world if the nation that talks about them behaves in a decent and humane way. And I don't think that since World War II, the United States again and again has used its military force for causes that did not involve democracy, that did not involve liberty, although these were the words that we used.
Mm-hmm.
And we were not, certainly we were not doing it in Vietnam, and I don't think we were doing it in the other wars since World War II. And it's always a question when you're thinking about war and whether war is justified, you have to ask, you know, what are we gaining by this war? That is, what in freedom and justice and democracy and human rights, what is being gained? And then you have to ask, you know, what is being lost? And, let's take the current situation in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to ask, what have we gained in these months, many months of bombing Afghanistan? Have we, in fact, succeeded in rooting out terrorism, in stopping terrorism? And nobody knows what we've succeeded in doing.
Well, the administration would say, I guess, that we've succeeded in unseating a fundamentalist Taliban government that was opposed to democracy, even in its own country, that we've broken up the training camps for terrorists that were inside Afghanistan, that we have scattered the terrorist leadership, if not rooted it out. And I guess with the completion of the Loya Jirga, the Grand Council in Kabul last week, that we've given Afghanistan a chance to get on a road to democracy, and perhaps with its women less oppressed than they were 6 months ago. It doesn't sound on the surface like a bad outcome.
Well, getting rid of the Taliban is a good thing. Getting more rights for women is a good thing. But, of course, that's not what we went into Afghanistan for. That's not the reason we went to war. Mm. And if we were going to go to war to liberate women, then we would have to go to war against Saudi Arabia. If we were going to go
not,
to war
not
to...
Not likely.
Not likely. If we were going to go to war to create a more free society, we'd probably go to war against Turkey and lots of other places in the world. So, you know, that wasn't it. We went to war presumably to do something about terrorism. And as you say, well, they talk about, well, Al-Qaeda is on the run. Are they? If they're running, where are they running? All you had to do is listen to Bush's State of the Union address and you, I think, get a clue to how successful we have been after all these months of bombing in doing anything about terrorism. Because at the very beginning of the State of the Union address, Bush said, we are winning the war against terrorism. A few paragraphs later, he says, there are tens of thousands of trained terrorists all over the world. And then he says, there's over a dozen countries from which terrorists can spring. So the idea of singling out a particular country like Afghanistan, which may very well have harbored terrorists and Al-Qaeda, but which is only one of 12 or 15 or 20 or 30 countries, what does it do? It means that we engage in an endless war. Are we going to engage in a war against any country that might harbor terrorism, including our own? Are we going to wage war against Hackensack, New Jersey?
Well, the president's been very clear. I guess he said we will wage war against any country that's determined to be harboring terrorists. And we've seen in the last week that if the terrorist is American, we'll pluck them right up as well.
Oh.
But it's because we're told there's a threat. We're going to come back and talk about how you might see that threat addressed. We're talking this hour with Professor Emeritus Howard Zinn, one of the country's most distinguished historians, anti-war, anti the war on terrorism. What do you think? Do we have the war on terror upside down and backwards? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Howard Zinn, decorated World War II bombardier and distinguished anti-war historian. We're talking with Howard Zinn about the anti-war on terror, maybe an attack on U.S. policies that may feed the terrorism that the U.S. has suffered in recent months. What do you think? Is America, as Howard Zinn says, creating more terrorists than it is disarming with its policies? Is it possible that we have the war on terrorism upside down and backwards? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Howard Zinn is in the studio tonight, and I think our analyst, Jack Beatty, is with us on the line now from Vermont. Are you there, Jack?
Can you hear me, Tom?
Loud and clear, and I think you've been listening to some of what Howard Zinn's had to say this evening.
Yeah.
Well, what's your first reaction, Jack?
Well, I mean, Howard Zinn has extraordinary moral authority, both as a decorated veteran, as you say, and as a moral witness against America's war in Vietnam and for civil rights. So he needs to be accorded and deserves the greatest respect. On the other hand, in this book, Terrorism and War, these interviews, I don't see that his moral intelligence is equal to that authority here. The right of war comes out of the right of self-defense, and you know, if nations are attacked, they exist for the purpose of defending their people. Now, you can say that what we did helped to bring on the attack. The fact is, the war was brought to us, and I don't see how it can be anything but just to respond to defend ourselves. Of course, if our response becomes exorbitant, if it becomes disproportionate to the threat to us, that's another matter. I don't think we've reached that point now, and we don't really know the scope of the threat. And as a practical matter, suppose we hadn't gone into Afghanistan. Well, we wouldn't know. We wouldn't have now Abu Zubaydah in custody. He wouldn't have told us about the late Mr. the terrorist formerly known as Padilla.
Jose Padilla.
We wouldn't have known about the radiological bombs. Right now in Afghanistan, with impunity, these terrorist camps could be doing their thing, preparing their bombs, getting ready to strike us again. How would we be morally ahead if we just basically lay down our arms and said, all right, hit us one more time? Where's the even utilitarian good in that? Because Americans would then die.
Howard Zinn?
Well, yeah, let's talk about self-defense.
Yes.
And let's talk about the utilitarian approach. Mm-hmm. It is not self-defense when you don't know who your attackers are, where they are. When we bomb villages in Afghanistan and we kill, and we don't know how many civilians died in our bombing, the estimates range from 1,000 to 5,000. That is not self-defense. Self-defense is when you can identify the attacker and you strike back against your attacker. Mm-hmm. So it is not self-defense when you strike back against a nation, a neighborhood, a family,
of course,
because you think that possibly, whoever attacked you is somehow there.
Of course,
self-defense.
But we've used that kind of military tactic before, even when the enemy, if you will, was not nearly as elusive as al-Qaeda. You yourself were part of bombing campaigns that bombed whole neighborhoods that were not necessarily munitions factories.
That was wrong. We did a lot of bombing in World War II, which was inhumane and wrong and did not contribute to the end of the war, that was not self-defense.
When the enemy is so elusive, what's a nation to do?
No, let's talk about what a nation should do, and that's where the utilitarian question comes in. What should a nation do? A nation should not strike out blindly, which is what we have done, against one country which may harbor terrorists, when terrorism is the kind of thing that is not confined to one country. And, I mean, the Bush administration has said so itself. It has said, you know, it's all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And so whatever we do in Afghanistan is not going to end the threat of terrorism. In the meantime, we kill thousands of people. We displace hundreds of thousands of people from their homes. Now, that is not utilitarian to me.
So you're saying go to root causes. Go to root causes for this terrorist
exactly.
threat. And how would you define those, Howard Zinn?
Well, let's look at some history of terrorism and responses to it. And the IRA has been engaged in terrorism for decades. The British reacted with force. Did that stop the terrorism? No. Terrorism continued on and on, continued until there was a root cause there. The root cause had to do with the freedom of Northern Ireland, freedom from British rule. Until the British made some concessions there, the terrorism had to continue. Look at the Jewish terrorism against Britain right after World War II.
And in what was then Palestine, you mean?
That's right. And the British reacted to Jewish terrorism with force. It didn't stop the Jewish terrorism. The only thing that stopped it was the promise of giving Jews their homeland.
So should we just take Osama bin Laden's list of demands and say, you got it?
Well, I don't think we should take Osama bin Laden's list of demands, but I think we should take the grievances that people have in the Middle East, whether Osama bin Laden has the same grievances or not. The important thing is not Osama bin Laden's grievances. The important thing is the reservoir of anger against the United States, which includes millions of people from which terrorists may spring. And we must ask the question, what is the reason for this anger against the United States? And the reasons are not hard to find. The reasons have to do with overwhelming military presence in the Middle East, the search for oil, which causes us to prop up military dictatorships in the Middle East. And what we should be thinking of is how can we make the United States a more humane power in the Middle East? We shouldn't be stationing troops in Saudi Arabia. We shouldn't be maintaining sanctions on Iraq, which have killed several hundred thousand people. We should not be supporting the state of Israel in its occupation of Palestine. These are the grievances. Now, if grievances are not justified, well, that's one thing. But these are grievances that are justified, just as the grievance of the IRA was justified, just as the grievances of the Palestinians today. I mean, look at Sharon. Sharon and Bush are following exactly the same tactics. The suicide bombers, terrorism, what do? You go on the attack. What's the result? In Israel, more suicide bombers. And we know that there are going to be suicide bombers going on and on until the fundamental grievance of the Palestinians is recognized. And same thing is true here for the United States. The grievances that people around the world have against the United States are going to have to be dealt with. This is what our government does not want to face. This is what a lot of Americans don't want to face. They want to face the fact that the United States can no longer be an overbearing superpower in the world.
But we're told in Israel and in some instances in the United States that these conflicts may be so deep that there is no compromise, that Palestinians won't be happy until they're right to the Mediterranean shore, that America will never be safe as long as there's Islamic fundamentalism, and that's irreducible.
There may be always fanatics in every group that has grievances who will never be satisfied. But the point is not to satisfy those fanatics, but to satisfy the large majority of people. And everything I've heard about the occupied territories indicates that most Palestinians would be happy with a Palestinian state. They would not want to drive Israel into the sea. And so I think, yes, we need to solve grievances, and we need to change the posture of the United States in the world, not just in the Middle East, but here we have troops in the Philippines. Here we have, you know, we've always had troops everywhere. We need to stop being a military superpower in the world. That's a hard thing for people to accept.
We're talking with Howard Zinn tonight about the war on terror and maybe an anti-war on terror, about U.S. policies as potential root causes of the terrorist threat. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. And Howard Zinn, a lot of people want to do that. So let's turn to the phones. Frank is on the line. Welcome, Frank. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
You're welcome.
When you talk about changing posture, it seems as though you're talking about winning over hearts and minds. And my question is for the speaker. I mean, how realistic do you think this really is? This is going on for generations, and it's generations to undo. And in the interim, you know, we need to be a lot more concerned about fighting fires, don't you think, as opposed to changing posture, as the speaker.
We got it, Frank. You're breaking up. But Howard Zinn, how about it? Frank
fighting
raises
the
time factor. He's saying maybe,
yes.
Even if you're right,
yes.
Isn't that going to take a long, long time? And the threat is immediate and scary.
No, I agree. Changing American foreign policy is not something that's done overnight. Although there are some things that you can do overnight. You can lift sanctions on Iraq overnight. You can bring the troops out of Saudi Arabia in a week. There are some things you can do immediately. But it's true that for a long-range change in American foreign policy, to change ourselves from a military superpower to a humanitarian superpower, yeah, that's long-term. And, yes, you have to do something immediately. But what you do immediately must not be something that makes things worse. You know, there's the Hippocratic principle for doctors. If you don't know exactly what to do, you're faced with a crisis, you feel you must do something, first principle is do no harm. Don't make things worse. We are making things worse by using military force, by bombing, by going to war, by threatening countries all over the place. That's not a good idea. That doesn't help us. Doesn't make us more secure.
But what about the threat of our enemies here, which I think can pretty much be defined under the heading Islamofascism? I mean, our enemies are anti-democracy, anti-woman, anti-science, anti-rationalism, anti-everything good about the West. They want to set the clock back in the Middle East. They are using grievances that are justified to advance their cause, just as the IRA in Ireland, an undemocratic movement that ruled by the gun, was using the gun to get what it wanted against a majority in Northern Ireland. And so I really think, Mr. Zinn, you go from just grievances to assume that somehow these groups that are our enemies from the grievances are somehow justified by those grievances, I think is totally wrong.
How do we pick apart that knot, Howard Zinn, of what you would describe as just grievances and on the other hand, what Jack Beattie is calling here Islamofascism?
Well, you know, when I hear phrases like Islamofascism, it reminds me too much of all the things that are done to lump people together. If you lump the people of Islam together with fascism, I think you're making a terrible mistake. There's fascism all over the world. There's Christian fascism. There's Jewish fascism. There's Islamic fascism. Fascism is not tied to a particular religion. And I think there's something very, frankly, nasty about tying fascism to Islam. If we really care about certain human rights, about the rights of women and so on, we'll go over that problem and deal with that problem wherever it exists, whether it exists in Islam or in the West. And I don't like the distinction that's made between the West and everybody else as if the West is a superior place. We are not a superior place. The West has engaged in terrible, terrible wars involving terrible atrocities and doesn't deserve to be considered superior to people in other parts of the world.
Stand by. Jessica is on the line. Jessica, welcome. You're on the air.
Thank you very much, Howardson. It's an honor. I was introduced to you by my sophomore high school teacher, so it's great to finally talk to you. My question was on the media. It seems to me that the large corporation media companies play a big role in Bush's fight on terrorism, and I was wondering what your ideas were on that.
Thank you, Jessica. Howardson?
Well, the media have certainly not played the role that media should play in a democracy. The media have not played the role of the watchdog of government. They've not been critical. The media have gone along. They've displayed flags on their television networks. Dan Rather, this important anchor, right? What is he anchored to anyway? He's anchored to the establishment. And he says immediately after the beginning of this war, he says, well, Bush is my president, and if Bush says stand in line, I ask where. The media have played a very, really pusillanimous role. I like to use a big word like that every once in a while.
Yes, Professor.
And they really, you know, we need a critical press. We need a press that will be independent. We need a press that will examine what the government does and what the government says and subject it to scrutiny. We haven't had that kind of a press.
Brian's on the line. Welcome, Brian. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. It's a great privilege to talk to Howard Zinn. I guess my question is, well, what do we do about that press? I mean, how do we get the word out to the people? I happen to agree with you on just about everything you're saying, but what do we do to sway public opinion?
Well,
thanks, Brian.
That relates to the previous question.
Yes, it does.
If the media are dominated by people who rush to declare their support for government policy, then people who oppose government policy have a very, very tough job. But remember, we had tough jobs before. We had tough jobs during the Vietnam War. Because at the, remember that when the war started, the population was mostly for the war. The media was mostly for the war. And what it means is that people who really believe that the government is wrong need to find ways of reaching people. And how do we do it? We do it by, well, we do it by smaller radio stations. We do it by WBUR. We do it by Pacifica. We do it by community radio stations. We do it by community newspapers. We do it by letters to the editor. We do it by calling in on Rush Limbaugh's show. We hold rallies. We hold teach-ins. There's going to be a rally Saturday at the Boston Common in the afternoon. We try our best to spread the word. Our faith is that if we are telling the truth and if we are making sense, that even though we don't have the enormous power of television, that the truth ultimately will be more powerful than their control of the media.
Howard Zinn, you've opposed wars before, but maybe never one that, as you write, promises to be a war without end. What is the prospect? What is the implication of an unending war, which is kind of implicit in some of the things President Bush has said?
Well, one of the terrifying implications of an unending war is that it means that the nation will be in a constant state of fear, a constant state of hysteria. We're going to have warnings every few days or every week about where a terrorist might strike. And when you create a war atmosphere, what you do is give the government the power, which it's now taking, to violate civil liberties, to pick up whoever it wants, whether they're charges or not. Citizens, non-citizens. And what you do is you give the government the power to take the taxes of American citizens and spend these taxes for war, for military, rather than for solving the problems of health and education, the environment, the fundamental problems that we need to be solved. In other words, a war without end becomes not just a war against terrorism, not even a war against terrorism, but a war against the American people.
But President Bush has very high support, very high ratings from the American people.
He does. And I think one of the reasons he does is because, one, the media have gone along with him, and two, is because I think there is not a strong enough sense of history that is in our culture. I think if there were more history in our culture, I think there'd be more suspicion of the government. Because when you look at the history of American foreign policy in this century and before, you see deception, you see lies, you see slogans thrown out, just like they're being thrown out now. Oh, we're doing it for self-defense. Oh, we're doing it for freedom. But no.
We're talking with historian Howard Zinn about the war on terror 9 months after 9/11. Do you think America is responding effectively, responding honestly to terror? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with historian Howard Zinn about the war on terror. He doesn't like it, and more than that, he doesn't think it will work. What do you think? Is war the only answer? Is it the best answer? Is it possible, as Howard Zinn suggests, that American military and economic domination is the root problem? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Howard Zinn, you pointed very recently in May, I guess, beyond the issue of perpetual war, beyond the loss of domestic citizen freedoms that you suggest that may entail, you say that the root problem here is an economic system that is inherently corrupt. You go after global capitalism, I guess would be the way of describing it, quoting the Pope, saying it's a savage and unbridled, that it creates all kinds of losers. Are you saying that what we thought was decided with the end of the Cold War, that capitalism had been proven to be the more effective system, that communism or socialism was discredited because of its own problems of repression and starvation and ineffectiveness? Are you trying to turn the clock back here? Or what exactly are you saying economically about the intersection of politics and economics?
Yeah. No, I'm not trying to turn the clock back, turn it forward. I'm trying to look ahead. I'm trying to get beyond capitalism and socialism, you see. I think, you know, the disintegration of the Soviet Union created this sort of immediate quick rush. Oh, socialism is bad, obviously, therefore capitalism is good. Well, first of all, socialism might be bad, but it doesn't mean that capitalism is good. However, I don't believe the Soviet Union represented socialism. Soviet Union, I believe, was a very, very distorted form of socialism. Socialism does not believe. I mean, the socialism of Eugene Debs, of Mother Jones, of Emma Goldman, of Upton Sinclair, that does not believe in dictatorship and police state. No.
So it sounds like you're open to another shot at it.
Another shot, a democratic socialism. Certainly not capitalism. Capitalism has not succeeded. I mean, what have we succeeded with in capitalism?
Well, people would point to the United States and
yes.
say, look at this wealth, look at this productivity.
That's true. A lot of wealth, a lot of productivity, and very badly distributed. When you have a country that has as much wealth as the United States and there are 40 million people without medical care, then that system isn't working. When you have a system as rich as the United States and you have to put 2 million people in prison, something is sick about that system. And when you have a country that is as rich as ours and spends $300 or $400 billion on the military and doesn't have enough money to pay teachers and nurses and social workers and child care workers, that system does not work.
I can hear President George W. Bush perhaps saying, Howard Zinn, you're a utopian. Yes, it's not perfect, but it's the best we've figured out how to do after all these eons on Earth, and we're doing the best we can with it.
It's the best that George Bush has figured out what to do, and it's the best for George Bush. And it's best for the oil companies, and it's best for the corporate interests that George Bush represents. It's not best for many Americans, because even those people in the United States who are doing well and who, you know, have television and cars and so on and so forth, they live in a state of anxiety and nervousness about the economy. But it's something even more than that. What about the rest of the world? What about the gap between rich and poor? What about we can congratulate ourselves on our great wealth, but it's a worldwide system. And what about Africa? What about the millions and millions of people in Africa who are dying of AIDS, and what is the United States doing about it? It's giving a pittance for the solution of the AIDS problem.
Jack Beatty, join us.
But Professor Zinn, even if all of those things we did tomorrow, and I'm in favor of all of them, we wouldn't change the fact that there are thousands of people out there who want to kill innocent American civilians. There was a booklet published by one of bin Laden's lieutenants that calls for that, that that's their end object and aim. They mean us harm. What can we do to stop them?
Well, if you can identify who these people are, really, really identify them and find them and lock them up, fine. Just as any time you can identify anybody who threatens to kill anybody or who is about to kill anybody, fine. Stop them from doing it. But because you feel a threat from somebody whom you can't find.
More than feel. We've seen the evidence. We saw the World Towers come down.
Oh, no. Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. The threat is there. The reality is there. Mm-hmm. But the point is, we don't know exactly where are the people who planned it. And we don't know how many more people there are who can plan similar things. And, you know, it's as if a murder is committed in your city and you discover and you think, you believe that the murderer has found refuge and has given refuge in a certain neighborhood. And what do? Do you bomb the neighborhood? Do you respond to this murder by committing other murders, by killing the families that live in that neighborhood? That's what we're doing. And that's what we will be doing if we go to war against Iraq or if we go to war against any other country. Look, war today is the killing of children. War is indiscriminate, inevitably indiscriminate. And when you engage in indiscriminate killing to supposedly defend yourself, you're doing the wrong thing.
Howard's in standby. A lot of people want to join this conversation. Julio is on the line. Welcome, Julio. You're on the air.
Welcome. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
First-time caller, I felt compelled to call into the show due to the fact that after hearing the outlandish statements by the professor, now I'm not sure where to start along the many points, but I would like to make the statement. The first issue that I take with the professor is to the issue of stationing troops abroad. He mentioned to Kuwait there was a perfect grievance that should be made by the folks in the Middle East. To the best of my knowledge, Kuwait's a sovereign nation, and it was attacked by another sovereign nation that needed help of another sovereign nation, the United States, in order to be able to repel the aggressor. And I was surprised by the professor's stance on that. The second point I would like to make, I'll be brief, is that the state of Israel. I opposed Israeli policies until a year and a half, 2 years ago, as to the use of the Palestinians. But to the best of my knowledge, Professor, in 1967, the Israelis are the ones who were attacked. They're the ones, they're not the aggressors initially. And the third point that I would like to make is you equated some of these grievances that are valid grievances to the IRA, the grievances with the IRA. When you look at the history of the IRA, and I lived abroad in Europe, the IRA was notorious for coming walking behind a simple police officer and putting two bullets in his head with his child next to him. I don't think those are valid grievances. And in order to conclude my statement and listen to your opinion as to it, it seems that you disagree as to the response that the United States government has done to the World Trade Center towers, and according to you, we shouldn't station troops anywhere. Therefore, what we should do is open up our pocketbooks and pay the folks in the Middle East more money and not get involved with that. Is that a correct assumption on my part?
Julio, thanks for the question. Howard's in.
Yes, that's a correct assumption on your part. It's a correct assumption to think that we should use our wealth to give people food and medicine and not to bomb them. That's a correct assumption. Let me go back to one or two other points you made, but, you know, you talked about Kuwait and
Israel, IRA.
Kuwait, Israel, IRA, a bunch of points. And, of course, it was wrong and a crime for Iraq to invade Kuwait. But then the problem is how do you react to it? And whether you react to it in a way that does even more harm than was done initially. Because what has happened, we went to war over Kuwait. We killed, we don't know how many people, 100,000 people. It led to sanctions on Iraq. It led to the deaths of several 100,000 people in Iraq. And there may have been ways of negotiating the withdrawal from Kuwait. There were several overtures that were made on the eve of war. The United States rejected those overtures. There are times when you need to think of alternatives to war when you consider that the war is going to do much more harm than good. Look, he talks about the IRA. I wasn't justifying the terrorism of the IRA. I was saying that behind the terrorism was the grievance of a lot of Irish who were not terrorists, and that grievance had to be met.
Howard Zinn, may I ask, behind your argument, behind your view of the world, if miraculously a president was to come into the White House who followed the Howard Zinn line, what would the United States look like 10 years later? Would we be a less affluent country? Would we be, would we look more like Chile or Argentina? Are you saying lay down your arms, lay down your affluence, join the crowd?
No, what I'm saying is stop being a military superpower in the world. And use your resources to build up your own society, to take care of your own people, to make sure that everybody has health care, make sure that everybody that has free education for everybody, make sure that everybody has housing, and help other people abroad. Yes, what will we look like? We look like a very good, humane country. We look like a country that believes in the principles of the Declaration of Independence, that all people have an equal right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. People in the United States and people abroad.
But would we be free, or would we then be under the, have some other powerful nation's foot on our neck?
Is Sweden free? Is Norway free? Is Denmark free? They're not superpowers. They don't send their troops all over the world. They don't send their navies all over the world.
If the United States hadn't opposed Nazi Germany, those countries you named might not be free.
Well, when you get into World War II, you're getting into a whole other complicated situation. I'm a volunteer. I was a bombardier in World War II. I believed in the cause. But I came out of it with a belief that ultimately war doesn't solve fundamental problems. And every war that we've engaged in since World War II has very clearly to me been a war that did more harm than good. The problem with World War II is that while it got rid of fascism, it gave war a good name. And war should not have a good name.
Let's get one more call. Joe, welcome. You're on the air. Be brief, please.
Hi,
Joe. We're running low on time. Make it fast.
Okay, yeah. something I'm really concerned about is the fact that the president knew of a imminent attack on America, and they already had an agreement with the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan to launch an attack on al-Qaeda on September 10th. And my question to you is, how much do you think this is about having a platform for the American people to say, let's go attack terrorism, let's attack al-Qaeda, but really put an infrastructure in to lay the groundwork for the oil pipelines from the Caspian Sea? And I think this has been in the works for quite a while, and I think the American people need to wake up and see the fact that, you know, this is about big corporation and big money and big oil people. And I think they knew that the terrorist attack was going to come. They thought, well, you know, one attack, how bad can it be? Not that bad, but...
Well, we got it, Joe, but that an attack on the Pentagon sounds somehow unlikely. Howard Zinn, is this about oil at the base? Is it that simple?
Well, let's put it this way. I mean, nothing is simple, but I would say one thing in answer to what this person has brought up, and that is certainly the reasons that we got a war have nothing to do with the reasons that are generally given by governments. And I say this on the basis of a long history of reasons given by governments for going to war and then real reasons. Oil, yes. Power, military power, yes. Political power, yes. Economic control, yes. These are the things to look for, not freedom, democracy. That's not what governments go to war for.
Howard Zinn, our time is running down. You've been writing and teaching and speaking against war for decades now. You're nearly 80. How does it make you feel to see the United States, as you approach 80 years of age, in the kind of posture and situations in today, in the midst of what promises, what we're told may be a perpetual or very long-term war against terror? What does this make you look back on your life's work and think?
Oh, well, if you're just saying that I alone have not succeeded.
No, it's not that. It's more just I'm fascinated. Yes. You're such a prominent figure holding this torch.
Because life is not worth living if you succumb to authority and lies and deception. Life is only worth living no matter how much life you have left, whether it's a year or 50 years. Life is only worth living if you feel you're working for peace, for justice, for decency.
Are we closer to the worldview that you've taught all these years today than in the past, or are we further away?
The governments are farther away. but I believe more and more people, I have faith in the common sense and common decency of people, that after a while they begin to see through the deceptions of the leaders of governments, not just our government, but governments all over the world. No government can really be trusted. And so I have faith that over time, and I lived in the South. It looked impossible. I saw people learn, black people, white people. I lived through the Vietnam War. I saw people learn. I think people will continue to learn and will come to second thoughts. And so I feel, yes, that's a possibility.
Howard Zinn, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for inviting me.
Howard Zinn is Professor Emeritus at Boston University. He's author of A People's History of the United States and most recently, Terrorism and War. Jack Beatty, just a few seconds for a last thought.
Oh, well, I agree with the professor that the great challenge, quoting him, of our time is how to deal with evil without killing huge numbers of people. Amen.
There's the challenge. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onepointradio.org and click on Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Support.